Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed the first part of Creation Science, the evidence that we did last week, where we talked about issues with old universe and issues with an old Earth and the evidence we have for young universe and a young Earth and the biology and how powerful that is. And then we listened to Dr. Berlinski poke holes in evolution and the way mainstream science looks at that. So if you haven't looked at that, get a chance to go back. And I love listening to Dr. Berlinski because he's just telling the truth. And I'm grateful for somebody that will do that. So again, this is Creation Science, the Evidence, Part 2. What mainstream science does not tell you. And I'll remind you, my name is Duane Orr. I'm a chief engineer at NASA's Columbia Scientific Balloon Facility. And you can see there the link to download these presentations, including videos. And this one's quite large because there's a lot of videos with it. It has my email address in case you want to get in contact with me. But one of my foundational quotes from John Lennox is, "It is the science I do understand that points me toward God. The science that I can look at the numbers and it makes sense, as opposed not the science I don't understand, not when they bring out mathematical formulas that show multiple universes or interesting things in biology or something like that. It just doesn't, those things that don't make sense, that aren't simple enough for me to understand, those are problems. But the things that I can understand, those point me toward God, and that's pretty powerful. So now we're going to go ahead and we're going to move to looking at star formations here. So the issues with distances to stars. How far are the stars? I'm going to tell you something. Scientists still don't know for sure. They're making a lot of assumptions. So it'll surprise you to learn that despite centuries of advancement in astronomy and astrophysics, from telescopes to cameras to CCDs to observations in space, we still don't have a satisfying answer when you consider that much of our understanding of the universe today, how it was born, how it came to be, the way it is, and what it's made of, is based on distances to stars. It highlights just how important this problem is. So no matter how you go about it, there's one key step we need to begin with, and that's an assumption-free method to measure distance to stars, distances to the nearest stars. And we only know of one, and we've known it since before the time of Galileo. It's the idea of parallax, which is purely a geometrical way to measure distance to stars. And you can see that graph on the right. What happens is you at one time a year, you have the telescope look at a star. And then 6 months later, when it's on the opposite end of the sun, you take a look at it again. And then you can have a triangle. You can have you can get those angles to that star. You know the distance between where the planet was and where it is now. You know that. So then you can come up with a distance of stars. And so regardless of what type of star you have, what its brightness is or how it's moving through space, parallax will tell you exactly. But the problem is we can only use parallax out to about 1,600 light years away. Only see about 100,000 stars that way. The rest of them require an assumption. Any distance given over 1,600 light years away is not fact-based, but requires an assumption of light intensity. And we do have a satellite was launched by European Space Agency in July 2014, hopes to provide accurate parallax to 4,800 light years away. So that'd be a little bit better. I haven't seen any results from that, but that's pretty powerful when you think about that. And so therefore, you have to make an assumption on that light intensity. And we'll talk a little bit more about that a little later, but that's our only error-free, fact-based way of doing it. Everything else, they're making an assumption on what that light intensity is and assuming that that tells them a distance. Understand that. How about this? Do we see stars form today? Physics refutes. Here's a big problem. Physics refutes the idea that gas particles naturally come together to build stars. Gas is very resistant to being compressed, and it's in a vacuum in space. So in a typical nebula, the gas pressure far exceeds gravity that would pull something together. So those that assert that stars still form today have several questions to answer for us. If a star is formed by natural forces, what are those natural forces that overcomes the outward pressure of that gas pressure? Has anyone actually seen a star form? Dr. Walker with the University of Arizona, a great guy, his experiment that we launched in Antarctica, I was down there one year, I think it was 2015 or 2016 when we launched him. He was looking at stars, and I got into detailed conversation with him one time. And he honestly, I said, well, I understand we haven't seen a star form. And he honestly said, well, Dwayne, it is kind of inferred. We're still trying to look, see if we can figure out how that mechanism happens. One of my favorite stories was a conference I was at one time in Aspen, Colorado. And a scientist got up, it was a small conference, and got up and gave a talk on star formation. And I was able to sit down with him at lunch. And I said, man, I really enjoyed your paper. But I'd always understood we'd never seen a star form. And he said, well, it's according to how you define star formation. So he said, you can define it three ways. And he starts going down these very technical, concepts of how stars are formed. Well, shortly after that, he started, another scientist, PhD guy who knew him, kind of walked up and said, heard us talking, said, what are y'all talking about? And I said, well, I told him I enjoyed his paper on star formation, but I thought we'd never seen a star form. Well, that gentleman looked at me, and then he looked over to the first scientist there, and he looked at him and said, we've never seen a star form. And then that guy looked at me and goes, yeah, we've never seen a star form. So it's powerful. When you ask basic questions, you can get some of these answers, and it's pretty funny when you get down to it. How about dark matter? Issues with dark matter and energy. Evolutionary astronomers have a problem. The universe is expanding at an ever-increasing rate. But if general relativity is an accurate cosmological model, and if the universe is made up of all kinds of matter and energy that are directly detectable, then its expansion should be slowing. The concept is, once the universe began, boom, then the particles start slowing down as they go further out. But that's not what we find. And it's a big difficulty. One enormous difficulty is that the Big Bang proponents have concluded that in order to explain this, that 95% of the stuff in the universe is composed of mysterious entities called dark matter and dark energy. But they don't know what these things are. How can Big Bang theorists claim to understand the process that supposedly brought the universe into existence when, by their own admission, 95% of the universe's contents are unknown? And I think that's important to understand. One of the three main arguments of the Big Bang is that it can account for the observed abundance of hydrogen and helium in the universe. However, this is because the model has adjustable parameters, and like tuning a dial on a radio. So Big Bang scientists choose values for this parameter to ensure the model matches the observed abundances of hydrogen and helium. So this is very convenient for them. And so no one knows what dark matter is or even if it really exists. By the way, I think it was on the order of 40 years ago, their estimate to the age of the universe was 16 billion years old. But once they started measuring the expansion rate and saw that it was moving much quicker than they understood, they had to drop it down to 13.8, which is what we are right now. And they have to make a lot of assumptions to do that. You know, between the time of the origins and the Big Bang, between the Big Bang and the time physics really starts to work, what is that time frame? That's an assumption they're making in their models. I asked one of the scientists in an article one year, I said, well, why don't you tell us these assumptions that you're making in order to tell us how old the universe is? Well, they're pretty good assumptions. I said, but they are assumptions, and we never hear that from them. You know, as an aerospace engineer, if I design a plane, assumptions are very critical. I need to know how many people are going to be on there, the estimated weight, how long you're going to fly, what altitude, those kinds of things. And they're critical to that assumption. And if you don't follow those assumptions, if you go beyond that, the plane won't work. Same with the bridge or library you want to build. If you're constructing a library, if you don't estimate the amount of the weight of the books you're going to put in, that library is not going to be built to what to the structural integrity to support everything that's going into it. Assumptions are critical. Ask What are your assumptions? Because they always have them. So we see this all the time, and they're very desperate to try to figure this out and try to understand what the expansion rate of the universe is, and they're having trouble figuring it out. Issues with the age of the universe calculation. So there's another hard concept for people to get their heads around, right? The Big Bang is an explosion in space, of space, not into space. In other words, galaxies are not flying away from each other through space, but the space itself is stretching between them and has been ever since the Big Bang. So it's meaningless to ask where the Big Bang occurred. It occurred everywhere. As Friedman put it, there's no center edge to the explosion. You know, and I like to think of it, you know, I have no problem with the Big Bang theory. As a matter of fact, I believe when God created it, it's probably a pretty big bang when he spoke. But the rest of it, about the age and everything, that's the thing we should question, right? So astronomers estimate the age of the universe in two ways. By looking for the oldest stars, and we know how bright a star looks, but to know how bright it really is, you have to know how far away it is. And like we discussed earlier, is it like a headlight a mile away or an airport beacon 10 miles away? Those can look very similar. And in the dark of the nighttime sky with no reference points, it's pretty hard to tell. So we see that becomes a critical component of figuring out age in the universe, and they're just making those assumptions. And by measuring the rate of expansion of the universe and extrapolating back to the Big Bang, just as crime detectives can trace an origin of a bullet from the holes in the wall, but the universe is expanding at an ever-increasing unknown rate. And that's the problem. So these origins, these time frame of the universe, those are all made on really big assumptions that we don't have a good understanding of. So we can see that. So we see this point here that these assumptions are that the universe is both homogeneous and isentropic, and we call this the cosmological principle, homogeneity. Homogeneity is the assumption that matter in the universe is uniformly distributed throughout space and that physical laws are the same everywhere. That's the assumption they have to make to come up with the age. And we know that that's not true. It is spread out. Particles, the matter is spread out, clumped together everywhere. It's not uniform. Also, isentropy is the assumption that the universe has the same properties in every direction. We also know that's not true. So these, again, are big assumptions they're making that I want you to be aware of, so you really can't count on those age calculations they make. So in questions of science, the authority of 1,000 is not worth the humble reasoning of a single individual. That's what Galileo said. He was a Christian scientist. And in God we trust, all others should bring data. I always say that. Bring me the data. Don't just give me your assumptions. So Einstein pointed out that if E equals mc squared is true, then there was a time when all that is never was. And this singular event represents the creation not only of the matter in the universe, but of space and time as well. So when God created everything, he created not just space, not just space and matter, but time. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. It's hard to put grap around it. But that's a mighty God we have. So what preceded the creation was not just a featureless void, but literally nothing at all. And Einstein knew that. And he didn't like that. So I'd like to point out that we have a scientist who won the Nobel Prize that used to fly on a balloon, but he put together he was instrumental or co-PI on a satellite experiment called the Cosmic Background Explorer, COBE, that proved back in the 90s that the universe had a beginning and was expanding, and it followed the things predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity. And in his book, Wrinkles in Time, he wrote, "If you're religious, it's like seeing God." Now, he admitted he was an atheist until he did this experiment. And then he had to be honest and say, I'm at least agnostic. I'm not really sure. It's a powerful quote in there. And the science community didn't like that he said that, but he was just being honest. And so let me explain this to you. This is what the Lord says in Isaiah 42:5. "He who created the heavens and stretched them out," how about that? That's in God's word, "expanded, who spread out the earth and all that comes out of it, who gives breath to its people and life and those who walk on it, Even our Bible talks about God expanding the universe, stretching it out. Wrinkles. This is Smoot talks about this in his Bible, in his book. Had all matter been evenly distributed, like the assumption they make, the fabric of space would have been smooth, and the interaction of photons with particles would have been homogeneous, resulting in a completely uniform background radiation. But our discovery of wrinkles reveals that matter was not uniformly distributed, that was already structured, thus forming the seeds out of which today's complex universe has grown. He goes on, it seems that the more we learn, the more we see how it all fits together, how there is an underlying unity to the sea of matter and stars and galaxies that surround us. Likewise, as we study the universe as a whole, we realize that the microcosm and the macrocosm are increasingly the same thing. What does that mean? What we see in the macrocosm, the big stuff, is that we see planets orbiting the sun. And then we also see universes orbiting. There's an orbit to them. They're on our Milky Way galaxy is full of those kinds of things. So that's a design. And then in the microcosm, what do we see? We see an atom. We see electrons orbiting a nucleus. Sounds like a designer to me, you know. He goes on. He says, by unifying them, we are learning that nature is as it is, not because it is the chance consequence of a random series of meaningless events. Quite the opposite. More and more, the universe appears to be as it is because it must be that way. Its evolution was written in its beginning, in its cosmic DNA, like it was designed. That's what we see. He goes on, go back further and further still, beyond the moment of creation. What then? What was there before the Big Bang? What was there before time began? He says, facing this, the ultimate question challenges our faith in the power of science to find explanation of nature. Is this, then, where scientific explanation breaks down and God takes over? You know, it's a powerful when we look at that, that designer is there, and we're finding more and more, everything we look at, the evidence of this design. Ravi Zacharias said, God has put enough in this world to make faith in him a most reasonable thing, and left enough out to make it impossible for us to live by sheer reason alone. Again, a scientific consensus is not science. And I tell you this, I would rather have questions that cannot be answered than answers that cannot be questioned. And that is evidence of the power of God's majesty in his creation. And I've read this before, but this is my go-to verse. First of all, this is 2 Peter 3, 3 through 7. First of all, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming? He promised. Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. But they deliberately forget, King James says willingly ignorant, I say they're dumb on purpose, that long ago by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water. That's creation. And that by these waters also, the world at that time was deluged and destroyed by the flood. And that's what we see in evolution. That's what we see in our science community. People are saying God didn't create it and he didn't judge it with a worldwide flood. God said, Peter said this, that's what they're going to say. And we're looking at that right now in our science community. By the same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. How powerful that is. I look at that verse and it's great. So, and I bring this up in both my presentations, but creation science argues what existed prior to the Big Bang. You either believe, as most evolutionists do, that something came from nothing, which violates all the known laws of physics, which states that mass cannot be created, or that the universe was created by intelligent design. That's really your only options, you know? And then where are all the transition fossils? There should be an abundance of transition fossils, much more than regular fossils. We should be able to see this transformation. We don't see any. The fossil record instead shows sudden appearance, very detailed, very intricate, very complex design, and it kind of stays the same. Maybe small changes, but not much. Also, what accounts for the presence of collagen, the soft fibrous connective tissue in dinosaur bones, supposedly hundreds of millions of years old? It should not be soft, but hard. And again, I'm not telling you how old it is. I'm just telling you they don't know, okay? And what accounts for the presence of measurable carbon, like we discussed, in all fossils that are tested? No carbon should be present in fossils over 100,000 years old, and we see carbon in everything that we take time to test. Fossils are evidence of a flood, something that died quickly and was buried. There's no other way we find fossils are created. I'd like to point out this creation conversation, and Dr. Vernon Cupp, who is now with the Institute of Creation Research, he ran the Radiation Physics Laboratory, the Radiocarbon Laboratory at Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Chicago area, where he directed and supervised radiochemical analysis laboratory from 1988 to 2011. And here's his statement. He said, "When one considers that the most reasonable explanation for fossils in various rock strata is a sudden catastrophic burial, along with the absence of transitional fossils, fossil forms in the rock strata, the presence of collagen in dinosaur bones, supposedly hundreds of millions of years old, and the presence of measurable carbon," he's covered everything we talked about, "C in the collagen, it becomes very difficult to hold an old earth view." And that's what brought him to Christianity. That's his testimony. And then I list below scientific dissent. I like that dissent, not like we descended, but a dissent, like we disagree from Darwinism, that during recent decades, new scientific evidence from many scientific disciplines such as cosmology, physics, biology, artificial intelligence research, and others have caused scientists to begin questioning Darwin's theory, central tenet of natural selection, and studying the evidence supporting it in greater detail. You can go to that website. There's plus 1,200 so far that are mainstream scientists that are disagreeing with these concepts of that the universe, how it's created, evolution, a lot of these things, because there's no evidence. They're being honest. Nice to see. So, as we wrap this up, again, Romans 1, 18 through 20 says, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness of wicked men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain for them because God made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." And I think this evidence shows we are without excuse because God's power is shown in his creation. Therefore, Romans 1:24 says, "God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for the lie." What's the lie? We don't need God. Did God really say that? Maybe he's not telling the truth. That's the lie Satan gives us. And he wants us to work with. If we can just have a little bit of doubt, that's okay. And that's all he needs. So the lie, "and worship and serve the creature rather than the creator." Evolution is a study of worshiping the creature rather than the creator. You know, and so how powerful that is that we see that truth in God's word. So you have a choice. Assume the Bible is wrong until science proves it right. Or assume the Bible is right until science proves it wrong. I would go with number two. How about you? It's the science I do understand that points me toward God, not the science I don't understand. Again, here's a list of the great resources here I have that you can, ICR.org. Go see that museum. You'll learn a lot. It's powerful for kids to see that. And get this subscription. Start reading it. You'll start understanding it, believe it or not. You will. And here's, again, my link to the creation science. You can download these presentations, look at the videos. I've had a ball. I hope you have. Lord bless you.